Hi, you were listening to What Do I Do from the Red Stick Ramblers, one of my favorite groups from their album Bring It On Down. I'm Sherry Edwards, your host for BBS Sound Health Radio Show. We'll be with you for the next hour, and I'm delighted that you could join us for a bit of conversation designed to provide options and information about sound health. The song that you just heard was about trust, or lack of it, really, in our society. That's about a man who's trapped between his feelings of obligation, what's socially right, and what he feels in his heart. And he's torn, and I think we're a society that's torn about the topic of trust. And tonight we're going to start the first in a series about why we can't trust anymore. We can't trust big pharma, the media, reporters, the legal system, bird flu warnings, healthcare system, vaccinations, medical supplies, and on and on and on and on. And we have two very special guests who are experts in this area of healthcare and trust. Ralph Fisatola, who is attorney, he's been here before to talk with us. And he has a very new and exciting announcement about Codex. And you're going to probably hear...
Hello, Sherry.
What? You there, Ralph?
Yes, I am.
Okay, our other guest is Larry Trivieri, who's an author about alternative health practices. You've probably seen his work in any doctor's office that deals with alternative health care, that big gray book that's so heavy called Alternative Medicine, The Alternative Guide. Both of these people are activists in health rights, and we're going to talk to them in a few moments about why we can't trust anymore, individually as well as a society. But as usual, we have a few announcements, and they're going to be short. Again, we're not taking phone calls tonight because we have two guests, so that you can send us questions through our email. That's soundhealth@soundhealth.org. Our first announcement is about Don and his crew and this great new look for the schedule. He's put something out to the host so that we can put information about who we're having on and a bit about them. So if you'll go to the bbsradio.com and look at our time, which is 6 Pacific time, and click on information about this show, you can see information there about Ralph and his website, how to get in touch with him, and Larry, and a bit about him and his newsletter and website. It's a very nice addition, and you can look at what's behind this series that we're trying to do. We have some follow-up for last week. We had a question from WT in Montana, and he wanted to challenge all of us and have us take a poll. It was about, which would you choose if you could be granted one wish? 1, immortality. 2, an unlimited checking account. And 3, a guaranteed good health for life, but you had to choose your day of death and a normal lifespan. Most of the people in this poll chose good health. So that shows you how important people are looking at health. But they didn't want to choose a time of death. They wanted to cheat and say, well, immortality, but I want to have good health. And I was surprised that at the poll that we were taking around the office of the people we were talking to, a lot of the young people chose an unlimited checking account. And Ralph is going to do our last announcement before we bring Larry on. Ralph's been with us before, and he's been talking about Codex, and he now has an exciting announcement. Ralph, where were you last week, and what happened?
I was I was in Ottawa, the capital of Canada, which is a beautiful city, and I was there for the 33rd, I believe it was, annual meeting of one of the Codex committees. Codex is structured, the Codex is the Codex Alimentarius, which is fancy for food code. It is a UN agency, which is actually sort of the grandchild of the United Nations. Its parents are the World Health Organization and the Food and Agricultural Organization. And those two organizations, 45 years ago or so, established the Codex system, which is an attempt to create a world food code to help improve health and to improve world trade and foodstuffs to make sure there was plenty of food available for everybody. The organization in the intervening 45 years has set up a series of standards which define what the various foods are that are in international trade. You know, what is Parmesan cheese, what is champagne, that sort of stuff. And if your products meet the standards, which are mandatory, then you can trade them internationally. But in addition to these standards, Codex has also come up over the years with a series of guidelines. And those guidelines are not mandatory, they're only advisory. The Codex rules say they're only advisory. But if individual countries adopt them as part of their law, then they become mandatory. And the latest of those guidelines was adopted last July in Rome, and it was something called the Vitamin and Mineral Guideline, which from the viewpoint of those of us who are in favor of freedom of choice in healthcare and broad access to nutrients, was a very bad guideline. It tries to treat dietary supplements as though they were, you know, industrial toxins or drugs, which they aren't. They're foods. And it tries to impose what they claim are safe upper limits for these dietary supplements. But by using a very restricted definition, by using the science of toxicology, which is the science you would use to look at drugs or chemical, industrial chemicals, you come up with safe upper limits that are so low as to be ineffective. So they would say a safe upper limit for vitamin C is 60 milligrams a day because that's what you need to prevent scurvy. Anything above that, you know, isn't, from that viewpoint, toxic. When the truth is that your body needs several grams of vitamin C a day at least for normal metabolic function. And so they look at these substances not as though they were part of our food chain, part of our normal metabolic function and normal life, but they look at them as though they were drugs. And then they come up with levels that are so low that they can't have any benefit. And that's, of course, the problem. They are going to limit people to nutrients that don't help, and therefore deprive people of the level of nutrition that makes a difference. For example, here in the U.S., people are used to being able to buy, you know, coenzyme Q10, being able to buy several grams of vitamin C per capsule. If you go to Germany, you can't buy more than 60 milligrams of vitamin C per capsule. And you can't buy coenzyme Q10 at all, even though according to Life Extension Foundation, it's one of the essential nutrients for longevity. A longevity which will be denied to you if you can't get the nutrient. So we consider what was done in Rome last year very dangerous. Well, it wasn't mandatory, but a lot of governments treat the guidelines as mandatory, and our own U.S. Food and Drug Administration has stated officially in the Federal Register that FDA will harmonize our law with international standards, even if they're not finalized. And, of course, we're concerned that FDA is going to try to harmonize us with these vitamin and mineral guidelines, thereby depriving Americans of access to high-potency nutrients. And we're not going to let that happen. And in Ottawa, basically, we saw some very interesting political infighting on a very high level. The EU and European countries around the EU would often take one position, and the United States would often take the opposite, it seemed. However, when it came to trying to clamp down on access to nutrients, both sides seemed to be standing on one side with a group of developing nations led by South Africa on the other side. And what the South Africans did was try to get the meeting to get down to specifics. That was because last year, WHO, the World Health Organization, came out with a new strategy. They call it their Global Strategy on Diet, Physical Activity, and Health. And in that strategy, they point out that that nutrition is really essential. Good nutrition is essential for preventing non-infectious diseases, the diseases that kill most people in the world, things like diabetes and heart disease. And with better diet, people would suffer from those diseases much less. Now, while the global strategy that HOW adopted doesn't really talk about dietary supplements directly, it does talk about the value of nutrition and the value of enriching foods with nutritional supplementation. And so it's very friendly towards dietary supplements. WHO told Codex last year, mm-hmm. You have to pay attention to this strategy, and we want you to adopt in your various bodies methods of bringing your work within the overall scope of this new global strategy. Well, the Kodak strategy had been to forbid any claims being made by anybody that nutrition, that better nutrition, would lead to better health. And WHO is telling Kodak, you have to change that. That's not the international scope any longer. And so what's happened is the first couple of meetings of committees under Kodak since WHO came down with this this requirement. The first meeting was one in which on the Kodak Committee on Nutrition and Special Foods for Special Dietary Needs. And that committee refused to even take up the global strategy, continuing effort to prevent a discussion of nutrition. However, the meeting in Ottawa, which was the Committee on Food Labeling, did take up the issue. And dutifully, each of the countries got up and paid lip service to this global strategy, which would help increase nutrition around the world. They paid lip service, and then South Africa got up and said, it's not enough just to pay lip service. Here are 11 specific steps that we can take right now to improve worldwide nutrition. And among those steps was to recognize that dietary supplements are not toxins and should be encouraged. And this brought the Europeans and the U.S. delegation into some sort of an alliance, but they were not able to prevent these basic ideas from being reflected in the report that this Codex Committee will send to the parent organization, the Codex Alimentarius Commission, which meets in July in Geneva and in Europe. And hopefully at that time, the entire Codex Commission will start taking some steps to encourage nutrition instead of discouraging nutrition. So
now,
we consider
it a good meeting. Let me see if I understand. If this had been adopted, and it wasn't, it would mean that we cannot buy vitamins on our own without a prescription or drug company interference.
Well, that's down the line. I mean, first of all, individual countries have to decide to enforce the guideline that was adopted last year, and then they'd have to enforce it in such a way as to set very low limits, and even if that happens, now you can't get a doctor's prescription. Doctors are not allowed to treat disease with vitamins. You know, it's a sort of situation where you wouldn't be allowed to buy vitamins, and even with a doctor's prescription, you still couldn't buy them because doctors cannot prescribe vitamins to treat disease. They should be able to, you know, but in the present state of our law, they're not allowed to do that, except for a handful of things called deficiency diseases. We go back to vitamin C and scurvy. You know, a doctor can prescribe 60 milligrams a day of vitamin C to prevent scurvy, but anything beyond that is beyond his scope of practice. MDs are not nutritionists, and nutritionists are not allowed to treat disease with nutrition, and neither are MDs.
Last time I read a statistic, 17 million people in America regularly take vitamins, and that's how many people.
70 million or more. I think it's much larger.
Well,
than
that's
that.
On a regular basis. There's a lot more taking them on an irregular basis.
Right.
Well, we know that
from other statistics that people are spending as much on alternatives in this country or complementary health care as they are on standard health care. Massage therapists and acupuncturists and nutritionists and all those professionals have very wide following in this country at the present time. And, you know, at the present time, we're protected with our dietary supplements with a law that Congress unanimously passed back in 1994, the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act, which is commonly known by its initials, which are pronounced DSHEA. So people talk about DSHEA, and it's the law that says that dietary supplements are foods, and of course they can have no safe upper limits because they're foods, and that people are allowed to make claims about those foods, about how they support either the normal function of the body, the normal structure of the body. But that law still does not allow people to freely make claims about dietary supplements, about how they prevent disease, or how they, or what type of therapy they are for disease. And while it's true that that dietary supplementation can help people with diseases in many ways, currently people are not allowed to be told about that. Their doctors don't know about it, and the nutritionists who do know about it are not allowed to really say it. So it's a very strange situation. It's contrary to reason, and there's a very famous U.S. Supreme Court decision of the year 2000 in which Sandra Day O'Connor, one of the last great cases that she wrote before she retired, where she said that restricting speech, controlling speech, should be the last thing the government does, not the first. And that was in a case having to do with compounding pharmacists being allowed to tell people what they do. And so the Supreme Court believes that people should have access to truthful information about products and services, and there shouldn't be these artificial restrictions that the law now imposes. And I think that as we go forward, people are going to have more and more access to truthful information. And as long as we can prevent any mandatory controls on what people are allowed to buy, the marketplace will provide better and more potent products all the time. I think
Ralph,
what happened in Ottawa is going to help move us in that direction.
Ralph, we want to bring Larry in.
Absolutely.
Larry
is one of the most knowledgeable people in this entire area, and his book is just extraordinary.
Larry, are you on with us?
Yes, I am.
Do you have any response to what Ralph is saying?
Well, he's absolutely right in terms of what's going on, and there's one thing that I'm sure you both know that wasn't mentioned, which is that this whole idea of restricting nutrient intake is a fallacy to begin with, simply because of how human beings are designed. We all have what's called unique biochemistry, and as a result of that, we have unique bio-nutritional needs. So, for instance, some people may need a much, much higher dose, take vitamin C, for instance, a much, much higher dose of vitamin C than someone else in order to have optimal health. And to have a situation, as you now do in Germany and other countries in Europe, where you cannot get more than 60 milligrams of vitamin C is absolutely ludicrous. And in a certain sense, it's criminal. One of the reasons that all of this is going on, as far as I'm concerned, is also what you and Ralph mentioned, which is that there are at least 70 million people in the United States who are regularly taking nutritional supplements. There's actually about 48% of the population that is choosing some form of quote-unquote alternative medicine as their primary form of health care. And that creates a economic threat to the powers that be, who are making a fortune and have been making a fortune in our healthcare system. You're probably both aware that our current annual cost, healthcare costs in the United States, are nearly $2 trillion. The last I heard, I think it was $1.8 trillion, and it's continuing to go higher. And yet at the same time, for all that money that we're spending, if you look at the actual statistics that compare the United States' state of health to other, quote-unquote, first-world countries, we rank very, very low on just about every category you can think of, including neonatal health, health of the developing fetus, and then the health of the newborn child. And this despite spending a far greater percentage of our per capita income on the United States as a country compared to other nations. So why is this inequity exist? Well, one of the reasons it exists is because there is so much dominance by what my friend C. Norman Shilly calls the medical mafia, which is big pharma and all of the interrelated things that go with that. And this goes back to what a lot of people don't know about in the United States, was that the very first national medical organization to ever be founded in the United States was the American Institute of Homeopathy, which was founded in 1844. Now, 2 years later, the American Medical Association was founded. One of the primary reasons it was founded was to put homeopathic practitioners out of business. That was actually stated in their agenda, and doctors that became members of the AMA, the American Medical Association, were told that they could not associate with practitioners of homeopathy, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, at that time, and this continued right up into the early part of the 20th century, at least 25% of all healthcare practitioners in the United States were holistic in their orientation. And their primary approach was proper diet, proper nutrition, which included supplementation, the use of herbs, the use of homeopathic remedies, and various forms of physical therapies, including exercise, chiropractic, osteopathic medicine. There was also quite a few naturopathic physicians, which was one of the original, from the European tradition, one of the original early comprehensive methods of holistic medicine. Then what happened in the early 20th century, in the early 1900s, a guy named Flexner, F-L-E-X-N-O-R.
Flexner Report.
The Flexner Report. He was commissioned to go across the nation and create a survey of the standards of medical education in this country. Now, on the face of it, that was a very worthy cause, because at that time, there was not a consistent standard of excellence, as you might call it, or a minimum standard of excellence in terms of what went into a medical education. It was literally at that time possible for someone to go to a two-day seminar and come out of it with a doctor's license. On the other hand, other people were going for 6 months for their training. Some people were going for 2 years of their training. It really depended on the school and the teachers that were giving this. Now, at the same time, at the beginning of the 20th century, our government was far different than it is today. We didn't have any national agencies such as the Food and Drug Administration, such as the Department of Health and Human Services, such as the National Institutes of Health. Basically, medical schools were allowed to do whatever they wanted to do, and the jurisdiction was at the hands of individual states, not the federal government. So what Flexner found what the report stated was that, I'm paraphrasing, but basically there was a huge problem with the medical educational system in the sense that there was no minimum standards of excellence, and therefore there were a lot of charlatans, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, that was absolutely true as far as it went, but what people didn't realize was that the agenda behind the Flexner Report was intentional. And there's basically, you may have discussed this, Sherry, in other of your radio shows, I'm not sure, but there's basically a three-stage process that people who want to create a result usually do when it comes to agitating the public. And the first is to create a problem. The second one is to create a reaction to that problem. And the third is to provide a solution to that problem. So what happened was when the Flexner Report came out, and to this day, the AMA says that it's the most significant, most important medical report that ever occurred in the United States. As a direct result of that, the people that wanted to take control of the healthcare system used all of their influence, and I'm talking about people like John D. Rockefeller, who at the time was the richest man in America, used all of their influence to have this broadcast throughout all of the newspapers of the time. And it was pretty much written in alarmist type of news. Well, bear in mind, the federal government was very limited in scope back then, the way our founding fathers had originally intended it to be, so they couldn't really do anything because we didn't have these various federal agencies. So what Rockefeller threw and his partners, and it wasn't just Rockefeller, but basically these people wanted to take control of the American healthcare system, and they realized the best way to do that was to take control of the medical schools. So what they did was they sent their agents through the Rockefeller Foundation and other so-called philanthropist organizations throughout the country and saying, look, we have this problem. The American public is very alarmed about it. They want to see change, and we'd like to help you bring about that change. We realize it'll take a lot of money to do so, and we realize you don't have the money to do it. So we'll do it. We'll provide the money. We'll do this on an annual basis. All they asked in exchange for that was control of the medical curriculum that was taught in the medical schools. So what happened was within a 10-year period from the time that this first started to happen, all but two of the medical schools that refused to accept the money were out of business. And the reason a lot of them refused to accept the money was simply because they realized what the agenda was, and it was going to eliminate teaching doctors about the very things that are essential to health, starting with diet, nutrition, physical exercise, things of that nature. So almost overnight, the medical schools that survived had a curriculum that no longer talked about diet, nutrition, no longer talked about any of these other therapies. All they talked about was drugs and surgery, and primarily drugs. And as a result, since that time, I'm talking of the early 1900s, since that time, the physicians that received a conventional medical education only learned about drugs and surgery. You know, the common statistic that the average conventionally trained physician in the United States, after going through 8 years of higher education to get his or her medical degree, during that entire eight-year period receives about 4 hours of nutritional education. 4 hours.
That's right, and that's barely enough time to even know that there is such a thing as nutrition.
It's barely enough time to read a chapter in a book, Ralph.
Exactly. You're absolutely correct, and you are, you know, it was very interesting for me to follow the changes in the Medical Practices Act. So I did some research for one of the cases I was handling and looked at how the law was changed from the late 1890s when the original Medical Practices Acts were written around the country, which included homeopathy and eclecticism and other forms of healing, and to the 1930s where they were revised and all of those complementary forms were excluded from the practice of medicine. To me, that means that doctors are not allowed to do that anymore, but other people are certainly allowed to.
And, that's absolutely
and
true.
There have been some changes in a positive way. Back in the 1990s, the chiropractors and others sued the AMA for restraint of trade.
Right.
And as a result of those lawsuits, the AMA Code of Ethics got changed. Well, probably they would deny that it was a direct result, but certainly the Code of Ethics got amended in the mid-1990s to include something called Ethics Opinion 3.04, which tells doctors that MDs are allowed to cooperate with other people, and it uses it in a very curious way. It says that physicians may refer patients to other physicians, to persons of limited license, by which they mean osteopaths and chiropractors
right.
and people like that, or, and it goes on, for diagnostic or therapeutic services to anyone permitted by law to offer those services which may be of benefit to the patient. And so the AMA created a new category which is just beginning to work its way down through the system to the point where medical boards are beginning to learn about it. They now divide it into two categories. There's treatment of disease, which is what medical doctors are licensed to do. It's, you know, cut and burn and use poisons. And we certainly want the use of poisons and dangerous modalities to be restricted to people who are trained, you know, to do that. But there's another category now, which is therapies that may benefit. And these therapies can be performed by anybody who's skilled to do them. And they don't need to meet the standard of curing a disease, but they're just things like taking vitamins and changing your lifestyle and all those good things that help prevent illness. And so I think there's now room in the system for a lot more of these complementary modalities. A lot of people in the system don't realize that yet, and it's up to those of us who, you know, like yourself, who've been promoting these complementary alternatives to let them know that it's okay. You know, they don't have to be afraid anymore. You know, they're not going to lose their jobs if people seek out alternatives and complementary approaches. I think
I agree with you. I agree with you overall. But I what you just said, based on what I'm aware of in this country, is still, from my perspective, overly optimistic, because people
right.
can still lose their jobs and have their professional careers destroyed if they go too far out on the limb.
In the health freedom movement, because I'm trying to find the good things that are developing, but I'm very aware of how many really excellent complementary MDs have lost their licenses, and never for practicing complementary medicine, always for some minor infraction which would never have had another doctor's license lifted.
Absolutely.
You know?
And in every single case that I'm aware of, and I know some of these people personally,
yes.
In every single case, the thing that made them a target in the first place from the medical boards and state regulatory agencies, and in some cases the FDA, was simply because they were actually achieving results for severe life-threatening illnesses.
Right, exactly.
Using practices that were considered
head-on for it, but it's always what brings up, what brings them to the attention of the authorities, and then the authorities find some infraction to hang them on. And there were four very fine leading female complementary physicians in New York State who have lost their licenses in the past 3 years.
Yep.
And we've watched it happen over and over again, in a very, in a very evil way. That's the only way one can describe it.
I want to back up here a minute and properly introduce Larry Trivieri. and then we'll go on with this great discussion. Larry is the founder and publisher of the Health Plus letter, which is free, I think, isn't it, Larry?
Yeah, it's free. It's an online newsletter. Mm-hmm.
And his website is www.healthyworld.com. And to tell you a bit about why Larry seems so knowledgeable about what he's talking about, he's the author of several books, The American Holistic Medical Association Guide to Holistic Health. He co-authored A Complete Self-Care Guide to Holistic Medicine, and he's the editor and writer of the first and second editions of Alternative Medicine, The Definitive Guide, and he authored Health on the Edge, Visionary Views of Healing in the New Millennium, my favorite, and one that we use for our classes here at Sound Health.
Well, I should let your audience know, Sherry, that I have no medical background whatsoever. I'm just basically been for close to 20 years now, very privileged and very fortunate to have the opportunity as a writer and researcher to have met literally hundreds and hundreds of really leading-edge healthcare practitioners, including yourself, who are doing things far beyond the scope of what most conventional physicians are not only capable of but are even aware of. And when I started to become aware of the results that these various therapies were achieving, particularly for diseases that are considered incurable or mostly incurable, I basically decided that I had to commit myself to letting other people know about this. And that's what I've been doing ever since. But all of the information that I write about is directly due to the associations I have with the experts. So I don't consider myself an expert by any means in a professional sense. I might consider myself a lay expert in the sense that I've been around it, so I have far more awareness than the average U.S. citizen. But it's really the doctors and other healers such as yourself that deserve the credit. I'm just the conduit for what they're teaching me.
Do you care if the rest of us consider you an expert?
If people want to dub me an expert, I'm not going to say no, but I'm just telling, I want my audience to know, you know, in terms of full disclosure, I'm not a medical expert in the truest sense of the word.
Is this from your experience as a writer, or did you have some personal health experience that started you digging into this?
Yeah, what happened to me, my story, and this is true actually not only of many people that convert to alternative medicine amongst the public, it's also true of many of the people within the holistic health professions. All of us at some point, or the majority of us at some point, had a health issue that conventional medicine couldn't cure. In my case, over a period of 12 months, there were two things that occurred. Neither one of them were serious, but they were certainly nuisances as far as I was concerned. One was that I partially passed a kidney stone, but I didn't pass the entire stone. And I was taken by a friend to the hospital when I initially partially passed it. And as anyone knows, had a kidney stone, it can be very painful. So a friend of mine rushed me to the hospital, and I was hooked up to IVs to have, you know, fluids flood through my body and stuff like that. And they took x-rays and said, sure enough, you have a kidney stone and you've partially passed it, but the rest of it is still down in the urethra, and, you know, you have to force fluids and this, that, and the other thing. So I did everything I was told, but the stone didn't pass any further. And so what happened was I started to have, for a period of about 4 months, I would intermittently have these very, very painful episodes in the back of my kidneys and my lower abdomen. And so out of desperation, I talked to a friend of mine who was from the Seychelles Islands in the Indian Ocean and was basically a self-trained healer to a certain extent. And he told me, you need to go see an homeopathic physician. I had no idea what that meant at the time, but I went. And I met this charming little man from Trinidad who was an homeopath that I was referred to by my friend. This is when I lived in New York City. And for literally an hour and a half, he sat there and asked me questions about my life. And the whole time I'm thinking, this is ridiculous. I have a kidney stone. Just give me the drug. You know, that was my orientation at the time. But he said, no, patience. I'm creating a profile of you. And I had no idea what he meant. But he was asking me how, you know, the nature of my dreams, whether I slept on my side or my back or my stomach, and all these questions. And then, long story short, he said, okay, this is the remedy that you need, and I want you to take it under your tongue every hour for the rest of today, and tomorrow you'll pass the stone. And I thought he was a very wonderful man who was completely misguided, and I had just wasted my time and money, but nonetheless, I was there, so I bought the remedy, and I took it just as he directed. And the next morning, as I went to pee, literally, the stone passed. But not only was I amazed that the stone passed, but what happened in that moment was I felt this powerful, powerful shifting of energies in my body. And I just felt more energetic, more at ease. I could not believe the amount of stress that my body was just literally letting go of. So I was intrigued by that, but not enough to explore what had happened and why it had happened. But then about a year later, I ended up sleeping under a air conditioner, the filter had not been used from the previous summer. And I caught a bacterial infection or some sort of infection from sleeping under that and developed bronchitis, which became chronic. And so, again, I went initially to a conventional doctor, and he told me I had bronchitis, and he prescribed a drug. And when I started to take the drug, I had a very violent reaction to it, so I said, the hell with that. I'll just suffer with this, but I'm not taking the drug anymore. And so what happened was, for the next 3 months, I had chronic bronchitis. It was low grade, but it was enough to sap my energy throughout each day and things of that nature. And a different friend at that point told me that I should try acupuncture. And so basically I was desperate, and I went to try acupuncture. In a single session, this female acupuncturist who had been trained in China, she read my pulse. Not only did she tell me everything that was going on in my body at that point, they do a thing where they press their fingers, for your listeners who don't know, into the wrist area, and they read your pulse. It's called pulse reading. But she also told me all sorts of things about my previous health history, including the year that I had lost my tonsils. And she hadn't even looked into my throat, but she knew I'd lost my tonsils when I was a child, had them taken out. And she said, okay, lie down, and I'm going to do the treatment. She did the treatment, and initially, I didn't feel anything. I just looked like I'm sitting there thinking I looked like a porcupine, but all of a sudden, this energy started to move through my body, and then sure enough, I started to feel a shift. And she told me to go home immediately and not stop anywhere, because I was going to soon start coughing up a lot of phlegm. And sure enough, that's exactly what happened. Within an hour of the treatment, I was expectorating all of this phlegm, and my bronchitis was gone. So both of these events happened in the mid-80s when I lived in New York City. So from that point, as a result of that, my curiosity was really lit, and I read anything I could get my hands on about alternative methods of healing, and I didn't have any other health issues, but I started to explore these therapies, as many of them as I could find, firsthand. So I went to chiropractors, I went to herbalists, I went to body workers, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that prepared me. In the meantime, all the work that I was doing as a writer was of an editorial nature and research nature. And then I eventually, in the early 90s, I moved to Los Angeles, where I met Burton Goldberg, and he hired me to become the editor and co-writer of what became Alternative Medicine, The Definitive Guide. And during that process, which was about 2 years, that's when I started to really meet a lot of the leading-edge healers. And it was basically like getting paid to go to college in terms of what I was learning. And I would go to these doctors' clinics, I would meet their patients, I would see the patient records of before and after, and I was just absolutely amazed that these things were possible and nobody knew about it. And I've been writing about it ever since.
So it became the passion of your life to let people know what the truth is?
Could you repeat that? I didn't hear you too well, Sherry.
You're very faint also. I can barely hear you. It became your passion then to share this truth with the people, because it was getting suppressed.
Yes, exactly. And it's still getting suppressed, even with all the positive things that Ralph has been talking about. And I agree, there's definitely a paradigm shift that we're in the midst of that I think will ultimately end in complete medical freedom, as well as freedom in other areas of life. But right now, the powers that be, they recognize that, and I really think they're doing everything in their and their current status of power to maintain their status quo. And the primary reason is I think, twofold. The first part is just purely economics. They want to continue to make as much money as they possibly can. But I think the other part has to do with fear. They're just afraid of change, and they don't understand how they can be part of that change and continue to profit without losing what they have.
Exactly. That's what we're facing. And certainly, on the other hand, some of the companies have begun to understand, even the big pharmaceutical companies. Someone like Hoffman Roche, that makes 80% of all the vitamin C on Earth,
sure,
probably make more money on selling vitamin C than they do on selling any of their drugs. And whenever they get a new drug approved, which is not that often these days, it's really an invitation to get sued when it turns out that, you know, 20,000 people die or something from the drug. Nobody ever sues them over vitamin C. So to some extent, some of those companies, and that's why all the big pharmaceutical companies have tried to buy up all the big vitamin companies.
Right.
That's why Twin Labs and GNC and those companies are now part of the pharmaceutical world, unfortunately.
I'm happy and unhappy at the same time to see drug companies like Pfizer using some of our techniques with vocal profiling to test their drugs.
They're beginning to learn that you can actually determine what's going on in a person's body by looking at their vocal analysis.
Mm-hmm.
And they're learning that because you've brought that to the attention of the world.
Yep. Well,
we just did an incredible study of some pregnant women that we're going to do a whole show about this, being able to look at all the hormones of pregnancy through vocal profiling. We have a question from the Internet, and it's from Charlene, and it's concerning the bird flu. And I'll just read it to you because I can't leave anything out. Some people say that one way to beat the bird flu is to give massive doses of vitamin C, as the bird flu is supposed to use up sodium ascorbate very fast, and those that get sick will have scurvy-like symptoms. Is this true? Can we trust that scenario to be true? And then there are other websites call this the George Bush flu, and say the Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld stands to make money from the drug Tamiflu. Can we really trust the administration?
I'd like to take the bird flu issue, if I could.
The way bird flu kills the few people that catch it is it so depletes their vitamin C stores that they die of what one doctor called fulminant scurvy. Scurvy that runs through the body so rapidly that the person dies from internal bleeding. And so that does seem to be true, that that's the mechanism by which bird flu harms. Right now, bird flu doesn't transmit easily from human to human, and that's because the virus itself, viruses have little, what we call them, keys on their surface, protein keys on the surface that fit into certain protein slots on cells of the host, that they're attacking. And right now, this particular virus fits most easily into cells that are found deep inside the human lungs. And as a result of that, it's hard for them to get out by coughing and infect other humans. But just two small genetic changes, according to some sources I've seen, would allow that virus to adhere to tissue that's much higher up toward the front of the lungs, where they could be expelled through coughing, and then the disease could become transmittable through the air, which, of course, is the great fear, because this disease is at least 50% deadly. And, compared to the Spanish flu back in 1918, which only killed about 5% of the people who got the disease, and that still killed millions of people. So it's obviously a great threat. Now, whether this is a real threat or not does depend on who you're listening to. And there are a lot of people out there who believe that bird flu is being manufactured by secret government agencies for the purpose of engaging in further population control. And certainly the U.S. government has announced that one of the things it's going to do if there's a bird flu pandemic is stop traveling, stop people from traveling. And so
this person
would be
is indicating that Rumsfeld owns part of the drug Tamiflu. Either of you know anything about that?
We've heard that rumor.
Oh, that's not a rumor. That's absolutely true. Rumsfeld owns stock in the manufacturer. I forget which company manufactures Tamiflu, but he does own stock, and his portfolio increased by at least $5 million because what happened was there was this big brouhaha from the Centers for Disease Control, the CDC, saying, you know, that we're unprepared and we need to stockpile vaccines and this, that, and the other thing. Despite the fact that less than 200 people around the world have died from bird flu, so it's hardly an epidemic, it's hardly even a threat. And in every single one of those cases, the people that died, there's no definitive proofs that the so-called bird flu virus was the cause of their death. In every single case, they were exposed. They were basically handling birds and handling bird feces and living in unsanitary conditions and things of that nature. So there's plenty of other cofactors that could have caused their deaths, none of which were properly researched. A similar thing happened with the so-called SARS epidemic, which we don't hear about anymore. But look at the machinations that were put in place at that point. But back to Rumsfeld, yes, what happened was there was this announcement that we were low on stockpiles, and so the federal government and also in England, all this money was expended to buy up the stockpiles of Tamiflu, even though all the scientists that were experts in this area said that the Tamiflu would be totally ineffective if a bird flu epidemic were ever able to go from bird to bird and transform and evolve so that it could pass from bird to human. And so his portfolio went up. I mentioned earlier, this is a perfect example of problem reaction solution. And on Tuesday of this week, ABC is doing their movie of the week during the May sweeps week. It's called Fatal Attraction, and it's about avian bird flu in America. And it's this fictional thing where 20 million people are supposedly going to be killed and all this other nonsense. And I'll bet you anything that some of the major commercial sponsors of that movie are going to be the pharmaceutical companies. Because
they always are. In fact, yeah. ABC News in the past couple of days had another major attack on vitamins. So
there's the tax on vitamins. Ralph, the attacks on vitamins have been taking place. They've been increasing exponentially in the past year.
Right.
And
I really don't believe it. And that goes back to Sherry's final question. I don't think that people trust what the media tells them or what the government tells them about health issues.
Well, they'd be wise not to, for two reasons. One of which is, and this isn't just in the field of healthcare, more and more of what passes for news in our country in the mainstream media, whether it's print news or radio television, is basically prepared press releases. In mainstream news, they're actually preparing corporate videos and they're passing them off as news pieces. And the reporters are sitting back and say, well, this is great. I don't have to do any work. Here's a press release, and I'll just write it up under my byline, which is exactly what the powers that be want. And so that's one thing. There's just a lack of journalistic integrity as far as I'm concerned. But even the journalists that are worth their weight in gold in terms of their skills, many of these journalists are not trained to ask the right questions because they're unfamiliar with it. An expert comes to them and says, you know, vitamin C is dangerous, you should print this. They'll print it without doing any follow-up. And if any follow-up does occur, it usually occurs months later at the earliest, and it's usually buried in the back of, you know, the page, whereas the big screaming headline about how dangerous the vitamin is usually front-page news.
In our local paper just this week, there's been two articles. One, area officials preparing for bird flu using the Bush administration bird flu response, and then a release from the CDC, milder than normal flu season coming to an end. Which do you believe? That's like crazy.
Well, speaking of flu in general, not the avian bird flu, but just flu in general, every single year during the coming months that precede flu season, the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, will make an announcement that gets reported as if it's gospel truth, which is that every single year in the United States, 36,000 people die of the flu, and therefore everyone should get flu vaccines. If you actually look on the CDC's own website, that's a fallacy. In most cases, nowhere near that number of people die of the flu. It's usually in the low thousands, like 1,000, 2,000 people. In many cases, in many years, it's less than 1,000 people. So again, it's not an epidemic. Also, those that do die are primarily elderly people who are already sick to begin with or in poor state of health. the majority of the people that do die during flu season.
We are
so again, there's not a direct correlation between the flu and the death.
At the end of our time, it was way too quick. I want to read a paragraph here. This was in the news today. Pfizer, and that's Pfizer Pharmaceuticals, sponsored over Nigerian drug trials. At the time of the Nigerian experiment, Pfizer was developing Trovan for release in the United States, where it was expected to gross up to $1 billion a year. The FDA never approved Trovan for use in treating American children, and this whole thing is about Nigerian children dying from this. After being cleared for adult use in 1997, the drug quickly became one of the most prescribed antibiotics in the United States, but Trovan was later associated with reports of liver damage and death, leading the FDA to severely restrict its use in 1999. European regulators banned the drug. We didn't even get to many, many topics. We just need to probably bring you guys back many, many times to get all of this out. I'd like to talk more about how the drug company is running the economics of our health system when it really needs to be people's need and people's health that's running. And I know we have to run on the finances of what's going on, but it's atrocious as to what's happening. We only have like 2 minutes left, but we need to do a show on options. Do you, and either of you, have things that we can provide to people, maybe post them on the internet, your internet site, of what people can do personally? This has been about mandated health from the top down. It's time that we, the people, made some demands from the bottom up, make this a political issue. What can people do on their own to help stop this? How can we band together what is really happening? We've brought up some great questions. Both of our guests have given us a lot to talk about, and we want to do a follow-up show about let's quit complaining and take some actions about this and put it in the hands of the people, because without trust, we don't have the courage to change what's already there. This is Sherry Edwards with Larry Trevieri and Ralph Fusitola. Talking about your trust in your healthcare system. There's a lot of other things involved, and we'll be back next week.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a Service to Others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.